Okay, that song had nothing to do with World War I. That was from Asteroid 2. I mean, I just got done telling you that you had to hear it before you die, so you're 1/9 of the way there. To hearing the album, not to dying. I mean, as far as I know, you could be, I guess. It's not really up to me either way. So let's get back to the subject of people who we all know are dead and have definitely not heard Asteroid 2. The armies of the Eastern Front, where the dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary, the country that kicked off a horrifying new era of modern warfare because its most beloved inbred trust fund baby got capped in a city his uncle's army was occupying, finally gets to stop their Serbian inferiors to the south, which is the entire reason the whole World War thing got started. So on April 15th, Austro-Hungarian forces crossed into Serbia just rage-horny to annihilate some Slavic shitstains who dared to fuck around and were now well overdue to find out. Which is why it only took them 4 days to open the Costco-sized can of whoop-ass they kept on the shelf with "Reserved for Serbia" scrawled on the lid and shit-stomped their way into the Battle of Sur, which they immediately lost. Yep. Look, I try to make heroes out of my subjects on this podcast, but only until the moment they decide to reject that assignment. Like a certain man in black who shall not be named Richie Blackmore. But I've seen enough, mother punchers. I'm calling it. Austria-Hungary fucking sucks. They were weak and stupid, and frankly, I'm glad they no longer exist. Which is also why I feel comfortable talking shit about them. And even if they did exist, what are they gonna do? Invade me? Not really their strong suit. I mean, come on, they declared war knowing that Germany would have to join them, and that Russia was not just going to let Germany go to war with a Slavic country, and on. So they blow up the fragile piece of the entire continent because Franz Ferdinand doesn't get to be the emperor? The guy who doesn't wear a bulletproof vest, which he owned? Or ride in an armored car, which was invented in 1905 for the Austro-Hungarian Empire? It was literally named the Austro-Daimler Panzerwagen. This dumb motherfucker got shot going to the hospital where two people were recovering from a grenade attack intended for him. Go home, Franz. The people of Sarajevo weren't chanting, "Let's go, Brandon." I just can't believe that this was the one man capable of running what could only generously be considered a mediocre country. Were there not other Austro-Hungarian Eric Trumps just littering the streets of Vienna? After the Battle of Sur, Germany had to send soldiers to fill in the ranks of the Austro-Hungarian army to give them a chance at success. And presumably, to show them which end of the rifle is the shooty one. Their forces scrambled back across the border in such a panic that a huge portion of the casualties resulted from soldiers who drowned trying to swim across a river. To be fair, I guess they'd all just had a really big lunch and just forgot to stretch. You gotta wait, guys. 30 minutes. You gotta wait. But let's move on from the Buster Bluth of European nation-states, because meanwhile, the allied country of Russia invades Germany and starts racking up wins until, in a completely unforeseeable twist of fate, they run out of weapons. Which I would imagine makes it hard to fight a war. I don't know. I'm no general. Between the battles of Tannenberg and the Masurian Lakes, the Russian 1st and 2nd armies were surrounded and almost completely destroyed. Their commanding officer, Alexander Samsonov. I was way off. And a small cadre of attendants tried to escape on horseback and eventually on foot. But late one night, Samsonov slipped out of camp with a revolver and shot himself in the woods. Well, he shot himself in the head, but his head was in the woods. Earlier in the day, Samsonov had been heard to say, "The Tsar trusted me. How can I face him now?" Again, Alex, you gotta wait. But if the results were looking mixed for the Allies in the East, things were looking downright bleak over in the West. Germany had pushed France and England to within 25 miles of Paris in what is known as the Great Retreat, which ought to be a lesson for all of us that failures are only failures if you name them that. It's why I'm currently going through what I call the tremendous divorce. I'm not, really, but I don't know. Maybe after this episode I will be. And here is where the momentum for the Allies begins to shift. The English commander John French was preparing to order a further retreat due to his lack of faith in well, the French. But the commander of the French army, who I really wish was named John English, had brought in reserves from the Eastern Front, which meant that the Allies now outnumbered the Germans, who had pushed so far, so fast, that they outran their supply lines. So on September 4th, the French general Joseph Joffre, fresh off of his ascension to the throne of Westeros, ordered a counterattack that drove the Germans back 140 miles in a battle known as the Miracle on the Marne. There are historians who say that the Marne is arguably the most important battle in the modern world, as it marked the ultimate failure of the Schlieffen Plan to end the war in 6 weeks. It also led the German commander Helmut von Moltke into the worst mental breakdown by a Nepo baby until the year 2011 with the invention of something called tiger blood. And seeing as the Miracle on the Marne was a victory for the English that resulted in the death of over 140,000 people, I thought the battle might be best explored by a death metal band from England with a song called For Victory. Yes, it was actually French tactical maneuvers and reserve forces that made the difference, but that doesn't fit into the mildly clever sentence I wanted to say, so now it's an English victory. That's right, the darling of death metal enthusiasts from Coventry to Canton, Ohio, Bolt Thrower, wrote 2 albums entirely about World War I, including their final record For Those Once Loyal in 2005 and For Victory in 1994, proving that they could indeed find cover art that does not resemble the wet dream of a 12-year-old child of divorce. And you know what? I even like the music on For Victory quite a bit. So here's the title track from that mid-90s magnum opus, the lyrics to which could be the internal monologue of a French or BEF soldier on the Marne, charging forward into enemy fire and their own mortality for victory.
As daylight returns, the fires of hope still burn. Along the dark nights, sitting by the mournful side, tears fall from eyes. Not sure what has been done. Sorrow creeps out my soul. All is lost, none have won.
Some lyrics of note here. Through time, war prevails. Thoughts, fears cast aside. Face the consequences alone, with honor, valor, pride. As fire fills the sky, we once believed in life. Now, time to die. For victory. For victory. What I especially appreciate about Carl Willett's lyrics here is that he manages to make a critique of the war from the perspective of a soldier without getting heavy-handed or breaking the established character. He's actually written a very sincere, if conflicted, perspective for the narrator's voice. The line immediately preceding the ones I just read is particularly effective for a song about charging into war, when he says simply, "unsure how it began." I just think that's beautifully unadorned poetry. It tells you so much about both the equivocal nature of soldiers at war and the absurdity of the situation into which they've been thrown. I know that I described the situation on the Western Front as bleak just now, but compared to where the war is headed, the Marne looks like Disneyland. Actually, in about 75 years, the Marne looks exactly like Disneyland, because that's where they put it. Disneyland Paris. I guess the real winner of World War I was the Kingdom of Magic. So the Allied forces pursue the Germans all the way back across the River Aisne, and in 2022, a French black metal band calling themselves FT-17 released an album titled Aisne 1914. The name FT-17 was taken from the Renault FT light tank, used exclusively in World War I and considered to be the first modern tank for its two-man interior layout and revolving turret. The FT doesn't actually stand for anything, it was just an internal code, but until I looked it up, I actually thought it stood for French tank. Because I should also not be the Emperor of Austria-Hungary. I'm going to play a mashup of two songs. The first is The Bayonets of Corbigny, and the second, apropos of the French and English forces giving chase upon the German retreat across the Aisne, is called The Pursuit.
Continue ta avancée.
Those guys are awesome. I watched a YouTube video of them at Metal Earth Festival in France. They have three vocalists, two who look exactly the way you'd expect, and one who looks like your tax preparation expert at H&R Block, complete with spectacles, male pattern baldness, and of course, a historically accurate French soldier uniform from World War I. I'm just going to take a guess and say that he's the guy behind the concept. Observation is my true gift. So, on September 13th, the German army finally turns to face the English and French because they found a highly defensible position. They don't like the Black Album either. And then, they found a really great place to fight. And the Allies knew it. So on September 14th, with no foreseeable way to gain advantage, the English commander, John French, orders the BEF to entrench. Basically, to dig a little ditch along the front line to make themselves more defensible. Of course, the BEF is equipped for mobile combat, so they didn't bring anything with which to actually dig a trench. What they end up doing is running men into local villages and farms to find whatever material they could that would allow them to dig. Well, all except for Private Shovel Hands Shannon, of course. Sure, they laughed at him in basic, but who's laughing now, jerks? Old Shovel Hands Shannon. That's who. So now both armies just sit there, exchanging fire for about 3 days, not really knowing what to do.
All right, mate, it's tea time. Oi, who spilled all the tea? Oh, well done, shovel hands.
Well, glory is fleeting. What happens next is a month-long series of flanking maneuvers. In combat, an army's strength is typically concentrated toward the front, so outflanking an opponent just means trying to get around to their side. You can imagine it like two parallel lines of troops facing one another. But if you can get part of your force perpendicular to the end of the other line, you're in a good position to encircle them, force a retreat,
or tickle them into surrender!
Hey, where the fuck did you come from?
The other Starbucks? Here's your café!
Thanks. Wait, is this the coffee I asked you for in March?
Yep, and speaking of foreign march, back to the show!
Speaking of foreign march. Hey, the guy knows how to button a scene. As for the co-belligerents of World War I, there was no further territory for either army to the south. They could only outflank and outflank-flank one another to the north. Unfortunately, neither side had learned from the historically disastrous miscalculations of General Lloyd Christmas that you can't triple flank a double flank. And this begins what is known as the Race to the Sea, where both the Central and Allied powers send their trailer park girls to go round the outside, trading flanking maneuvers until they reach the North Atlantic.
Flank you. Nein! Flank you! Yeah, flank you both very much.
This had the effect of creating roughly 400 miles of trenches where the two armies would more or less remain for the next 4 years. Breathe. Oh, I'm not supposed to read that part.
Hey, maybe Wilhelm II and I aren't so different after all.
Okay, so here we are. Trench warfare. If you've ever listened to The Last Podcast on the Left, which is a great horror comedy podcast, kind of like this one, only here the horror is the comedy. But they cover some fairly dark or gruesome topics on their show, and one of the things that they do is let the listeners know ahead of time that what they are about to hear is Gold Star territory, which means they are going to cover some particularly disturbing content, and if you listen to the whole thing, you get a gold star. You don't, actually. All you get is nightmares, but it's their clever homage to something like a trigger warning. I'm going to talk about trench warfare and play some music on the subject as well, and I want you all to stay with me so that I don't have to live alone in my head with this shit. But if you need to choose mental health today instead of And Volume for All, that's okay. And now is the time to do that. You've already heard pretty much a full episode, so you can just consider this bonus material that revisits you in the quiet moments of existence for the rest of your natural life. But we'll see you back here for episode 3. So if you look at pictures of the French army in World War I, you'll see two distinctly different types of uniform. The first was a holdover from the Napoleonic Wars. It was brightly colored with red trim and had kind of a jaunty cap that went with it. But after the introduction of trench warfare, The French army replaced those uniforms with a monochromatic style in a much darker shade called horizon blue to match the landscape and sky of the Western Front. The change came after waves of highly visible French soldiers were regularly ordered to charge into machine gun fire during the first year of the war. Blending into the background gave Allied soldiers better percentages for survival when facing the German machine guns, but it couldn't save them. A letter home from a soldier named Frank Graves recalled watching an entire line of men before him being cut down like grass from a scythe. And a lieutenant named Richard Kelly described seeing the carnage before the sound was able to reach him, saying, "The noise of the German machine guns was completely inaudible, and as I watched, the ranks were thinned out and torn apart by a silent death that seemed to strike them from nowhere. It was peculiarly horrible." I doubt that the significance was lost on the first soldiers to enter the trenches at the Battle of the Aisne, that after a few days they found digging to a depth of 3 feet, a little under a meter, was insufficient, and so were ordered to begin digging themselves trenches to a depth of roughly 2 meters, or a little over 6 feet. Human beings are incredibly resilient creatures, both physically and psychologically, and I like to imagine that the perpetual dread of that situation would eventually be replaced by a kind of self-protective sense of normalcy. But the passage of time in the trenches seems only to have invented new horrors. Stuart Cloetta was a British schoolboy inscripted into the war at the age of 17 and wrote, "Where we fought several times over the same ground, bodies became incorporated in the material of the trenches themselves." I just want to reiterate that idea for some sadistic reason. The people who died in the trenches literally became the trenches. While that is a particularly horrible fate for the dead, it's somehow unimaginably worse for those who had to continue living. As Cloetta elaborated, they were putrid with the consistency of camembert cheese. "I once fell and put my hand right through the belly of a man. It was days before I got the smell out of my nails." At one point, the bodies had piled up so high that his battalion could no longer move through the trenches with efficiency, and so they attempted to remove them. He wrote that the corpses came to pieces in your hands. As you lifted a body by the arms and leg, the torso detached. Even worse was that each one was crawling with maggots and covered inches deep with a black fur of flies, which flew up into your face, mouth, eyes, and nostrils. We worked with sandbags on our hands, stopping every now and then to puke. Cloetta concluded that the visceral torments of trench warfare was not the worst of it, calling his time in World War I a nightmare of fear, hardship, exhaustion, and unbelievable loneliness. "I was not particularly afraid of being killed." I think in two different ways, I kind of understand that. What stands out for me in so many of these stories is both a pervasive sense of inhumanity and at the same time a kind of seemingly unkillable humanity. In the first sense, everywhere was the imagery of total war, animals feeding on other animals. This is Stuart Cloetta on the scenes from No Man's Land, the liminal space between opposing trenches. The sun swelled up the bodies with gas and often turned them almost navy blue. When the gas escaped, they dried up like mummies, frozen in their death positions, kneeling bodies, sitting bodies. The crows pecked out the eyes, and rats lived on the bodies in the abandoned dugouts. These rats were very large and quite fearless. Their familiarity with the dead made them contemptuous of the living. One night, one fell on my face, and it was biting me. In the second sense, men like 19-year-old George Main found himself in the enemy trenches with a dying German soldier crying for his mother and asking for water. He wrote, "I am glad to this day that I gave him a drink." There were, of course, the common indignities like that of immersion foot syndrome, or more commonly, trench foot, a condition caused by standing in fetid water for extended periods of time, causing the feet to itch or tingle at first, followed shortly by total numbness and eventually rot. And then there were the indignities that no living creature, human or otherwise, should have ever had to suffer. An English private named Joe Murray told the story of a friend who he said was smart and upright as a guardsman until he got dysentery. It was dreadful to see him crawling about, his trousers round his feet, his backside hanging out, everything soiled. He couldn't even walk. So I took him by one arm, and another pal got a hold of him by the other, and we dragged him to the latrine. We tried to keep the flies off him and turn him around, but he simply rolled into the trench, half sideways, head first into the slime. We didn't have the strength to pull him out, and he couldn't help himself at all, so he drowned in his own excrement. Ugh. World War I might be a good topic, thought the myopic idiot. When soldiers did make it out of the trenches, it was often to go, as they referred to it, over the top and into no man's land to charge the enemy position. I'm sorry, I'm just pausing here to try to stop myself from making a Sylvester Stallone arm wrestling joke. Please just know that I could have, and that I chose not to. Mine is a quiet heroism. Many soldiers who survived advances into no man's land soon after retreated into nihilism, like 23-year-old Charles Bertram, who said, "From that moment, all my religion died. After that journey, all my teaching and belief in God left me, never to return." Others found poetry in the grand meaninglessness, tinged with hopes of small meaning, like Guy Chapman, who wrote, "Your life and death are nothing to these fields, no more than it is to the man planning the next attack. Your death will not prevent future wars, will not make the world safer for your children. Yet by your courage in tribulation, by your cheerfulness before the dirty devices of this world, you have won the love of those who watched you." I read a lot from a soldier named George Rudge, who described the madness and futility of the charge through no man's land, saying, "We were just meant to be sacrificed as we ran into a wall of steel." Remembering, one chap had the bottom of his jaw blown off and still kept going forward until he dropped. Or the soldier who, in the midst of the charge, just threw his rifle down and refused to move. That image is so striking, I think, if you have kids, which might sound odd, but for all the instances of suicide and literal madness that Rudge talks about, there's something about the picture of a grown man almost petulant in his defiance of not just the order, but also the idea of war. It's simultaneously righteous and deeply naive, like a four-year-old stamping their foot and screaming with clenched fists because you said casually that the dog wouldn't live forever, as if their rage at the idea will defy canine mortality. I don't know why, but I find hope in that image for some reason. Rudge also admitted this was the first time that I had killed anybody. And when things quieted down, I went and looked at a German I knew I had shot, and I remembered thinking that he looked old enough to have a family. Concluding, I felt very sorry. After the war, Rudge and many, many others suffered from mental breakdowns as well as from the lasting effect of gas attacks. The use of weaponized gas began where the race to the sea ended, on the Belgian coast, the setting for the first, second, and third battles of Ypres, or Ypres, as Americans might pronounce it. Not to be confused with the Battle of Ypres Love, which is less a battle and more of a journey. I'm sorry, I just have to make a joke every few minutes, or I think my liver will fail? I don't know. It's just what I've always assumed would happen. April 22nd, 1915 was the start of the Second Battle of Ypres, which has the inglorious distinction of being the first usage of gas attacks by German forces against the Allies. In 1914, a Nobel Prize-winning chemist, fierce German nationalist, and certifiable asshole named Fritz Haber became the head of the chemistry section in the German Ministry of War and immediately began working on the weaponization of gases. His first attempt to poison mass numbers of people came in the form of chlorine.
Yay!
In a gaseous state, chlorine can mix with water to form hydrochloric acid, which is exactly what it was intended to do after being inhaled into the lungs of soldiers. On May 5th, Private Harry Cox, God damn it, really? Come on. Okay, Private Harold Cox Wald told how he evaded the effects of a German gas attack that took place riverside, saying, "And how I got out of it? I went up a tree. you know, gas being heavier than air. They all went down in the shallow trenches, of course. They all laid out sprawling and suffering agonies. Actually, the battalion was wiped out. There was only 5 men left. When the gas attack was over and the all-clear sounded, I decided to go see what was happening. When I looked along the bank, it was absolutely covered with bodies. Must have been over 1,000 of them. Yeah, 1,100 actually. But because the Germans weren't prepared for how effective the chlorine would be, they didn't take advantage of the moment and made absolutely zero forward progress as a result. But soon, Fritz Haber decided that chlorine was a bit obvious because it was bright yellow and smelled like pepper and pineapple, also because he was an evil piece of shit. So he switched it up and used something called phosgene, which is odorless and disrupts the ability of the blood to carry oxygen to the body, slowly suffocating the victim over a period of 48 hours.
Aw, 48 hours? But Fritz Haber wants it now!
And then, of course, the Allies started using gas masks so they wouldn't suffocate slowly. Okay, boo-hoo babies, how about this? Haber starts working with mustard gas, which, as Internaut describes, absorbs in your perspiration, causing chemical burns on contact, as well as blisters that ooze yellow fluid. I hope it's Gatorade. And to deal with that, you probably have to take off your gas mask. Oh! So now Haber starts doing combos.
Chill out, dickwad.
Little bit of mustard, little bit of chlorine, and after 4 years of pointless trench warfare, he had managed to murder roughly 91,000 people without firing a single shot. In the words of the inimitable Norm MacDonald, what a genius. He'll be missed. But then this irredeemable cretin went on to find redemption in 1918, winning a Nobel Prize for discovering how to make blind children into stew, I bet. I'm assuming. I don't know what it was for. Just a second. Okay, he invented the Haber-Bosch process. Oh, you know, the one that we all celebrate on Haber-Bosch Process Day as such an intrinsically important and enriching part of our lives. And what exactly does the Haber-Bosch process do? I also don't know. Hold on. The process allows a large-scale production of ammonia. Great. Would he run out after injecting too much into the eyes of kittens? Let me read this. Larger quantities of nitrogen-based fertilizers, supporting greater agricultural yields, used to provide food for over half of the world's population. Only half? Whatever. Fuck Fritz Haber. Probably doesn't tip. Anyway, I think I've tortured myself and all of you long enough today, and I feel like we've all earned some more clean vocals, don't you? I mean, after the amount of the first-hand stories of trench warfare that I read for this podcast, I'll never feel clean again. So listening to some pristine vocals might be the closest I'll ever get. I'm going to start episode 3 with this same 4-song medley on trench war for any of those who missed it. So I'll keep my intro here brief, and we can all dig into the bands and lyrics when next we meet. Thank you for taking that horrifying fucking journey with me today. It wasn't easy, but that said, it also wasn't fun. I promise that when we return to the subject of World War I, I will not be talking about a man slowly drowning in a ditch filled with his own shit, because they only had one good song and it was a grindcore cover of Daydream Believer. In contrast, here are some really dark songs about our really dark topic today, and hopefully they will serve as a reminder and comfort to us all that great art can emerge from great tragedy. We begin by returning to FT-17 with an unlisted vocalist on The Last Trench, followed by 1914, the Ukrainian Black and Death Doom band bringing the heavy like a motherfucker with the song Gas Mask. Then a Welsh sludge band, yay, sludge! Tides of Sulfur with the song Trenchfoot. And once again, Belgian black metal from the band Suntold with Suicide in the Trenches. Finally, we end where we began with the conclusion of The Last Trench by FT-17. And I promise to dig 6 feet deep into all of them on the next and volume for all.